You're listening to the Young Opportunist Podcast.
Hey guys, welcome back to the podcast. In this episode, we were lucky enough to get Owen Rusk back on the show for another episode. Owen is the founder of Rusk Australia and the host of Australia's two largest podcasts, the Australian Finance Podcast and the Australian Investors Podcast. If you haven't listened to episode 15, we highly recommend you do so now, as we cover his incredible journey and dive into how he built Rusk Australia. It was an awesome episode.
In this episode, however, you will learn the importance of investing early and taking advantage of compound interest, the Rusk five-factor investing philosophy for identifying winners, the key differences of value and growth investing, practical strategies you can utilize to diversify your investments, behavioral tendencies that can hinder your ability to make sound investment decisions and ways to minimize them, and much, much more.
We really hope you guys can take some value from this episode and apply some of the strategies discussed within your own investing journey.
Let's get underway with today's episode. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. We're honored to be once again joined by Owen Rusk. As we said in the introduction to this episode, we're talking about something I think all three of us are quite passionate about, and that's investing and then the psychology of money. So Owen, thanks again for joining us. It's an absolute pleasure. Welcome again to the podcast.
Thanks, guys. It's my absolute pleasure to be back.
So I guess before we dive into the episode and unpick all things investing in psychology of money, a lot of our listeners are relatively young, either making their way through uni or recently started their careers. Can you quickly talk us through the importance of investing early and consistently and what impact it can have on individuals' wealth in the future?
Yeah, sure. So the best line that I ever heard about compound interest was the money that money makes, makes more money. And that came from one of Australia's wealthiest people, who is a, I don't know if he's a multi-billionaire, but he's definitely a billionaire now, which is Hamish Douglass from Magellan. He said that in an interview that I had with him. Wow. And he basically said, like, his point right before that one was, you don't want to make investments with your money and your time that give you a 50% return in 1 year and a 50% return the next year. You want to make an investment with your time and your money that pays you 10% for the next 20 years. Because if you take that road, you're going to find that compounding is so much more powerful for your life. And so it's not just when we talk about compound interest, we think about, you know, it's the eighth wonder of the world, according to some guy that said it years ago and all this sort of thing. And we think about money, but compounding is more than just money. Compounding comes back to knowledge as well. And we spoke about this in a previous chat where we talked about like having all of these different kind of fields of knowledge and letting them grow over time. And so one of the things you don't have when you're younger is money. Like, you don't have a lot of it, but you have a lot of time, and that time gives you the opportunity to learn. But then there become a time where you don't have time and you have money. And so then you want to have the tools to know how to compound that too. So start with whatever it is that you can compound now. Start with the knowledge, investing in yourself. And then start moving on to money and think about, you know, we'll talk about that in the rest of the show, but money can come after that. But I mean, if you can do both at the same time, do it. Even $10 makes a big difference.
Yeah, for sure. That's awesome advice. Even straight off the bat, when we first launched the podcast, I think we had an intro episode, and I remember we said in it, like, if we can, as we're young, pick little things from these conversations we're having with people or doing your own research, you can carry that, as you just said, for the rest of your life, which is pretty incredible. We all the time when we're doing interviews, we relate it back to episode 2 or episode 3. Like, I think we do it too much, but yeah. Because we're just, yeah, we correlate different things, and then we come up with a solution.
And then when you hear something, you find that you pick up on it when it's said again.
Mm.
And you're like, I know that from somewhere. I've listened to that from somewhere, and it's always in the past. Yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's why we go to school at the beginning of our lives and not the end of it, right? So we can compound for the rest of our life. And so that's why we try and accumulate knowledge when we're young. And then it grows exponentially throughout our lifetime. So yeah, that's awesome. You guys want to just make sure that compound interest is like in the forefront of everyone's mind and compounding in general. I ask this one question at the end of every episode, which is, what's the number one thing you'd teach your younger self or say to your younger self if you could go back in time? And maybe 80% of my guests have said compounding. So wow. Get it into your head that how important compounding is.
We would love to hear your opinion on individual stock picking versus the typical ETF approach to investing. Can people really outperform the market?
Yeah. So, yes, I would say yes, they can. So full disclosure, like, our business is built on basically picking individual shares and picking individual ETFs and then helping people, you know, amass wealth from doing that? I would say yes, from stock picking versus ETFs. Let's just unpack those for some of the listeners that don't really know what that is. So typically when you approach the stock market, you have a choice. You can invest in individual companies. So like you say, I want to buy Telstra shares, you go and buy Telstra shares. Or you can buy a basket. And a basket is also known as an ETF, exchange traded fund. So not EFT, that's what happens when you pay for your coffee, an ETF. So think of it as a basket. So instead of buying Telstra shares, you might say, I'm going to buy all of the telecommunications companies in one investment. And basically you buy the basket, not the individual item. It'd be like if you go to the shopping center or a supermarket and, you know, instead of picking up the bread, picking up the, you know, the tomato and the cheese separately, and you go and do all that, you just get, you know, a ready-made sandwich and it's good to go. You just make one investment and you get a little bit of everything in it. And that's basically what an ETF is. And so people have a choice to make. They can become individual stock market stock pickers, or they can invest in ETFs. Well, actually, I should say that's a false choice. And we're presented with many false choices in our investing. And so what I mean by that is people think that we have to do both, but I would say, sorry, we have to do one or the other, but I'd say do both. So go and start with one, learn about that, and then move on to the other one if you want to. And so if we just take a backward step, you asked, basically, should we be picking individual stocks when we can just buy an ETF? And the reality is that you don't have to. So here I am, someone that says, you know, we're paid to help people pick individual stocks and ETFs. But the realistic thing is you could just go out and buy like a handful of really low cost, simple ETFs, and you would grow wealthy over the long term. The problem is most people get bored with that, to be honest. Like, it's great and I think they should stick with it. Like I invest in ETFs, but many people also want to invest in individual shares because they want to either try their hand or they want to learn more about companies, and they find that really exciting. And so they go and do that as well. And I think that's perfectly healthy. I think, you know, I wrote about this on the weekend in our newsletter. I don't think it's all or nothing. Like, I think you can have a plan A and a plan B, and your plan A could be, I'm just going to dollar cost average into ETFs, meaning I'm just going to put in the same amount every month and just buy the same ETFs and just do something boring. And I'm going to buy some individual shares around the outside. And basically, if your plan A fails, i.e. you've got your shares and they don't work out, at least you've still got the original things that you invested in. So you still have that kind of backstop. And that's the way that I think about it. I think reality is you can make money from individual stocks. Not many people do it successfully over the long term. And if you're not that interested in finance, don't worry, you don't have to, because your plan B is brilliant. Just go and buy some low-cost ETFs.
Great point. I love that. And obviously, it comes down to everyone's personal situation and their goals and objectives. But would you consider that like a 70-30 kind of thing, saying 70% of the investment money to put into an ETF and play around with the 30? I know that's quite a hard question to answer.
That's fine.
Is that the case?
Yeah, so I would say you're right, mate. There's no hard or fast rule to this. I would say I wouldn't necessarily break it down in percentages. What I would say is start with the ETFs. Don't start with the individual shares. So this can really catch people off guard, particularly young males who love to like invest in specky mining companies that happen to be based out of Zimbabwe and it's going to be the next big thing. And it's almost as good as crypto, right? So, you know, convincing those young fellas in particular, like I'm stereotyping here, it's not all young blokes, but that's typically what I come across. We love to find the next big thing, right? Like I had that when I was younger.
Yeah.
I invested in a great company that 14x'd, meaning it went up 14 times in 1 year. Took all that money and basically just blew it up in the next year. So that happens. And it was a lesson, you know, it was a good lesson to learn. Mm. And you probably couldn't have convinced me to go invest in the ASX 200 ETF. Like that would have been boring as anything. I probably wouldn't have done it. But that said, I wish I did at least invest some of my money into that, rather than say, you know, if I've got $2,000, I'm just going to put it all into this. It was actually it was a liquefied natural gas company that didn't even have a project yet. And it just so happened that it went up 14 times and I made a lot of money. Instead of just putting all $2,000 in that, I'm going to take $1,000. I'm going to put that in a boring ETF and just hold that for the next 5 years. And I'm going to play with the other money there. And it's not a very scientific approach, but what I would say is if you only had to have the choice, try and pick the ETF first. You can always add the individual shares later. And I think that's a safer way because it allows you to get your emotions in tune with what is required to be a long-term investor. Because even in ETFs, they're not risk-free. You're still going to have that up and down, that volatility, as you know. So that's where I would start. And then over time, as you go through that 3 to 5 year apprenticeship, which is what I call it, you will find that you feel more confident, in which case you can start adding, say, 20% of your savings towards individual shares as well as the ETFs.
And nowadays, the ETFs are getting exciting. I just listened to your episode on the hydrogen ETF. That was an awesome episode. And yeah, that's exciting stuff. And it's not your classic old boring, like, kind of ETF.
Top 100. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I think there's merit in, I guess, like, both approaches. And I was listening to a podcast just the other day. I can't remember the person that interviewed, but he's all for picking all of his own stocks and doing a bit of trading. I think he said he did like 100 trades a day, small trades a day or something. He's a billionaire, so don't compare yourself to him. But what he said is, he would rather do what he's been doing for the rest of his life, even if it doesn't make him as much money. So let's say, like, we're 21, till we're 31, we try trade the whole time. He's like, at the end of the 10 years, imagine how much you've learned about money, finance, your own psychology, all of these things. And then you compare that to someone in those 10 years that just traded in an ETF, put no time into it. They've ended up with maybe a steady 10% return, 8% return over the 10 years. They may have actually outperformed this guy, but when it comes down to the educational side of thing, he's obviously like 10x that. So it's interesting. It's an interesting concept. And that was the first time I've ever thought about the idea of trading or investing, picking stocks and being like, oh, there's actually merit to learning about, yeah, that side of things. But as you said, it comes down to the type of person and what their interests are, because some people couldn't think of anything worse than looking into the financial statements and trying to figure out if their PE is good or not. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair enough. So what I would say just at the outset is I'd probably draw a line between what is investing and what is trading. Some people confuse the two because they think that to buy shares, you have to trade. And you do. You basically place a trade. It's either a buy or a sell. So then everything becomes trading from that point on. Yes, but there is a defining term here, which I would say is investing is different to trading. So when we think about trading as kind of an industry, what we think about is we think about people with very short-term focus. So that might be a day, like what we call intraday. It could be a weekly time frame. You might say, I'm going to buy Telstra today. I'm going to sell it on Friday because I think it might go up. Investors, in my opinion, should be investing for no less than 3 to 5 years. So no less. And so if you just think about the time frame there, if you're trying to find a business, like, and when I say business, a share is just an ownership of a business. So if you're trying to invest in a business for 5 years, the first thing you're going to do is make sure that that business is going to be able to last 5 years. So that's that kind of old saying, like, the only way to finish first is to first finish. And so you have to find a company that's resilient. Like, let's say ARB, which makes the bull bars that you see on full drives getting around. That's Anthony Ronald Brown is the guy who founded that. I think it was in the 70s, and now his sons run it. And it's expanded overseas. It's got manufacturing in Thailand and all over. And basically, ARB is the type of investment that people should be making and learning about. So it's not necessarily, when I say, you know, go and buy individual stocks, what I say is, be a long-term investor in individual stocks. So find the ARB, research the heck out of that company, its industry, and everything that makes that bull bar so much better than TJM. There's probably going to be someone with a TJM bull bar listening. Sorry about that. Why does ARB make better bull bars? Why do people choose ARB? And that whole psychology of investing, of money, of business is fascinating stuff. And that's the stuff that is really interesting about investing. Not so much like the dollars in your brokerage account, but actually seeing that. So when I think about investing, I think, yes, you can use ETFs as your core, and then you build around the outside long-term investments, but in individual shares as well. And so, you know, I know that some people do day trading and they trade frequently. That's definitely not for me. So I don't think I've made 100 trades in probably the last 4 or 5 years. Maybe I have in the last 4 or 5 years. I might be close to that, but majority of them would have been a buy. I think we've only sold three investments over the past 3 years, I think it is. So We typically just buy great companies and hold on to them. And I think that's a fascinating way to learn, to your point, about learning about investing while also benefiting from the gains that come from the long-term compounding of ETFs. So you can basically, you can have your cake and eat it too. You don't have to pick knowledge or money. You can do both.
It's a great caveat. And I'm glad you said that, because I think a lot of people even listening, all we see over social media is these day traders that are making billions of dollars, and you can do it too. So when they think of investing, it's true. You can morph it with the idea of trading and day trading. But it is a dangerous thing, because they are very different things, and the investment strategy and the psychology behind it is very different as well.
Yeah. And I would wholeheartedly agree with you, mate. And the reality is, what you see online is not necessarily what you should be modeling yourself off. Then again, what you see from professionals is not necessarily what you should be modeling yourself off. I think in the last conversation that we had, we talked about that line from Morgan Housel, which basically said, you know, being good with money has less to do with how smart you are and more to do with how you behave. And most of us behave differently in different environments, and we have different pursuits and interests. And so we should all consider that. Like when we hear information from the outside, is that relevant for me? Chances are it's not. Like, I think 99% of the stuff that we listen to is absolute noise. It's rubbish. And it's only the 1% that really changes your life. And so you should be focused on that 1%. Like what actually matters. Oftentimes, like, I think that this is a great quote from Jason Zweig, who is the Wall Street Journal columnist. And he basically said, I'm paid to say the same thing 200 different ways every year. And his point was that, like, the good principles of long-term investing don't change. What changes is basically the noise around us and how people get mixed up in all of the different things that go on in the media, the market crash, this, that, and the other. You know, I don't listen to the news just as a rule of thumb. Like, people say, oh, did you hear about this thing, this terrible thing that happened? I said, nope, no idea, because I just don't listen. Because in investing, typically the best source of information is the direct source. So if you're thinking about investing in a company or an ETF, you go and read what that company or that ETF does. That's your primary source of information. And I don't just mean primary, like, source of where it comes from. It's actually, like, the best place that you should be researching. And it's not as hard as you think to go to Telstra's website and download the annual report, find out what they're doing. If you can understand the business, then the rest of that noise stuff becomes a lot easier to filter.
100%.
And you touched on your method of finding good investments. Do you use any, like, discounted cash flows or look at the earnings for that company?
Yeah, sure. So that's a good question, Reese. So basically, we have these five principles that we look for. And the first one is, and I don't win points for originality here. I'm just carrying a lot of the great ideas that have come from investors before me. The first one is that you want to look for something that's in your circle of competence, or at least this is what we do. So take all of the things around you and which are the businesses or industries that you understand. And so for me, I'm not a geologist. I don't understand mining. So I don't go near that sector. So I tend to stay away from that. I'm not into microbiology or biotechnology. So I don't go near those sectors and those businesses. So as an initial filter, I just want to, there was this saying that it struck me. It was from a guy called Steve Johnson from Forager Funds in Sydney. And he basically said, when you're looking for investment ideas, you're not looking for the yes answer, as in, yes, I will invest in this. You're trying to find the quickest way to know. So you're trying to find out, why wouldn't I invest in this company ASAP? So you don't waste your time with it. So if you have a certain checklist of things that you have in mind, like, say you want to invest in companies that are in growing industries. Well, don't look in the industries that are dying, like newspapers. Don't invest there. And that's a really easy way to just knock things out of your kind of list. And so the circle of competence is basically that for us. It's like, what are we good at? What do we know? What are we passionate about? Let's focus on those. The second thing is, we've got to have management teams that have skin in the game, meaning that they own some of the shares in their companies. I talked about ARB a second ago. That's actually run by the sons of the guy that started it. So it's in the family. Family run businesses are probably the best businesses after founder run businesses. The third thing that we're looking for is basically growth. So is this industry capable of growing? And is this company capable of growing? So podcasting is an interesting example because podcasts are growing rapidly. I would say that they're going to take over a lot of the blog sphere and like what we do in blogs. Mm. Then you could even look and say something like TikTok versus Instagram. TikTok is growing much faster, at least in percentage terms, than Instagram. And so you can identify, you know, which businesses are growing, which industries are growing, et cetera, et cetera. The fourth thing that we look for is what we call a moat. This is like that old ring of water around a castle. It's basically what protects the castle, meaning the business inside, from the competition, from the people on the outside. And so the wider the moat, the better. And so you want to find companies with the widest moats. So what's a wide moat? Well, a good example would be Apple. So, Apple has its trademark brand. Like you see that half-eaten apple, the apple with a bite out of it. You think, okay, I know what that is straight away. It's got a really strong brand. I know if it's an Apple device, it's going to work with my other devices. And once I start using an Apple device, I'm going to find it really hard to give up that piece of software. And so that's what we call a switching cost. A very high switching cost is a type of moat. A brand is a type of moat. But also Apple can produce widgets. And even though it may not seem like it, they can produce the iPhone, which I'm holding up here, for a lot cheaper than, say, the three of us could go and create a smartphone manufacturing company and go and build one. And that's what we call efficient scale. So it's such a big scale that it's impossible to compete with. Now, Reese, the final thing is valuation. And you brought up this idea of DCFs, or discounted cash flow analysis, which is getting really geeky and into the weeds on investing, and I love it. So discounted cash flow analysis basically takes the future value of a company's ability to generate cash, uses that kind of NPV formula that we had when we were going through school and learning about these things, and then puts that into today's dollars. And then we compare that against the share price to determine if something is over or undervalued. If the valuation is above the share price, then we would say that it's undervalued. So we could buy it for the share price. And this is like, you know, we do these calculations in our heads. And this is the fifth point, but I'll get back to it in just a sec. We do this calculation in our heads. When we go in, I use the example of like a pair of Nikes, right? If you go into the store and you see Nikes at Platypus for $150 and you think, whoa, that's really expensive. You might get someone else that goes into the store and stands right beside you and says, whoa, they look cheap. And then you think, what? They're the same pair of Nikes. How can someone say they're more expensive? And I'm saying they're like too expensive. How can two people see the same thing and say something's worth more or less? And the reality is that sometimes some investors are willing to pay more for shares than you are, and that's okay too. But you've got to do your own kind of valuation work and determine how much is this thing worth to me and to based on what I think it's worth. And then you've got to make that kind of, even if it's not necessarily a hardcore calculation like a DCF, maybe it's just like, oh, Apple's, you know, growing in its smartphones are still growing and it's got this huge Apple streaming and subscriptions and blah, blah, blah. And they're going to get X number of subscriptions. Well, if that's the case, you might think that the business is undervalued. So, we use DCFs, but not to the extent that many investors probably think. I think the reality is that people think that DCFs are kind of like a silver bullet, but the more and more you go on and invest, the more you realize that that type of work, while incredibly important and it kind of needs to be done, doesn't make it a final decision. That's why I made it number 5 on the list, not number 1. So that's a long-winded way of saying how we go through the process.
That's incredible. And I love all those points. I think I'll definitely adopt some of those into my own personal investing journey. And I love the Peter Lynch approach to investing as well, that whole customer approach. And it's so simple. Like he used the example of the typical male in the relationship saying that he's going to buy this undervalued stock and it's going to have so much potential. And then he compared that to his wife, who doesn't know anything according to the husband, but could have invested into a retail shop selling clothes and that has so much potential. So it can be as simple as that, as walking around, having your lenses open a bit and observing like, wow, this is a good company, they're doing good things and I enjoy shopping here or purchasing their goods and services. So yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, I'd rather own a great business and not think about the valuation than I buy a really cheap, like air quotes, cheap company and worry about it every day. Like I'd just rather just strap on for the ride and just hold a company that might be, yeah, it might look, everyone might be calling it overvalued, but that's okay. You know, one of the things that is one of the interesting inversions in terms of investing in mental models is that if everyone says it's expensive, then it can't be overvalued because everyone says it's expensive. Mm. So it's like this, that's the Yogi Berra quote, no one goes there anymore, it's too busy. If everyone says that investment is so wildly expensive, like if this is what the big, you know, Wall Street banks and media empires are saying, well, then maybe it's not. Sure, it might be, but maybe it's not because of that very reason. So there's an interesting inversion there.
That kind of moves like nicely onto this next point. We sort of touched on both, I guess, strategies in this, but love to spend some time sort of comparing two main investing strategies. I want to provide some, I guess, definitions and break it down. So the first one's growth investing, which simply put is investing in a company that is anticipated to grow at a rate significantly above the average growth of the market. So let's say Tesla, for example. The other one is value investing, which is the classic sort of Warren Buffett, Benjamin Graham sort of investing type, which is an investment strategy that involves picking stocks that appear to be trading far less than their intrinsic or book value. So essentially, after reviewing a company's financial statements, you find that the stock price is trading far below what you think it should be worth. So I guess over the past couple of years, growth investing has sort of outperformed value investing by a huge margin. I've heard that this outperformance is not actually structural, meaning that value is dead for say, but it's more cyclical. I mean, it's more of a cycle and it'll come back. So I'd love to hear your opinion on, I guess, firstly, these two strategies, which strategy you subscribe to because you touched on both, and what is your opinion on the idea of value being so-called dead?
Yeah, sure. So this is an interesting thing, and I think it's an important definition that you bring into it, Ben, which is just identifying what people tend to, where people tend to kind of plant their flag. Some people say, I'm a value investor, I'm going to find cheap stocks. And then the other one's like, I'm a growth investor, I'm going to find fast growth companies. But the reality is that they are the same thing. Because you can have a cheap stock that's growing really fast. And you can overpay for a fast growing stock. And so there's really like, it's like a continuum. It's not really necessarily this one's value, that one's growth. When we hear the studies, here's an interesting thing. When we talk about the studies and we read the research and they talk about value versus growth, what they're actually talking about is the quantitative side of investing. So they're saying companies with low valuations versus companies with high valuations, how have they performed? And the reality is most investors don't go into their stock brokerage account and go, I'm going to buy every stock that's below 10 times price earnings ratio. And they don't do that. That's like the quantitative way to invest. I interviewed a quantitative investor here today, actually. And that's a very quantitative way to look at it. So what I would say to for most people that are weighing this up is don't necessarily try and pick which one you are. Just try and find out which type of business you want to own and which type of investment you want to own. And if it just so happens that that company 1 year might look like it's cheap, and then the next year might look like it's expensive, that's fine. Mm. I think your point more broadly though, more broadly looking at the types of companies that people buy, I would say that I'm a growth investor. Because if I fit that definition, like of finding companies that grow for a very long time, I think if you're value investing in the traditional sense, you have to take a shorter term time horizon, because what you're effectively hoping for is if you buy something cheap, that it becomes less cheap in a year or two. And typically the reason that something becomes less cheap, you know, it goes from being undervalued to fair value, is because of sentiment or psychology of the market. Not so much because of the other stuff that goes on. Whereas if you're investing for 10 years, like I try to, what you want to identify is the growth, because the growth does the heavy lifting over a longer period of time than the valuation. Like for example, if you can buy a company that's making $10 a profit today, but in 10 years, it's making $100 a profit, the valuation that you pay today doesn't have nearly as big of an impact as if you buy a company that has that $10 profit today, but in 10 years, it's making $12 profit. So it's not, the margin for error isn't really there. And so what we're trying to do is trying to find those long-term growth companies. But at any one point along that line from here to 10 years, you could say that it's cheap, in which case it might be a value stock. I don't know if I've really had like concise thoughts there, but basically to say that they're both very much the same. And, you know, it depends on time horizon. In a sense.
No, I like that because, and especially on that point where you said, you know, I'm a value investor, I'm a growth investor. It kind of like just puts barriers around capital growth and gains, I guess, and wealth at the end of the day, because it's like, oh, no, you know, I'm a value investor. I don't touch those kind of stocks and investments like that. So yeah, I love that you brought up that point.
I love the way you're talking about stocks. You're referring to them as companies, because when it comes down to it, owning a stock is owning a part of a company, which I think is an important thing to think of. It's like, we're about to get into that, I guess, the psychology behind money, but that's a great starting point. If you sort of, instead of you opening up your portfolio and you're looking at a bunch of stocks you bought, and you don't really have the meaning behind it, then that changes the way you sort of act around them. And Warren Buffett says the same thing. Like I think he just saw heaps of, like, he saw Coke being drunk like everywhere, like in rubbish bins and all of these things. And he's like, oh, this is a household name. And he's like, oh, well, what a great business. This is not going away anytime soon. I'm going to own the company and not really worry about, I guess, like what it's valued at, or like the stocker, I guess.
Yeah. There's this great book called The Outsiders. It's by Will Thorndike. And a lot of long-term investors will talk about this book if you have them on the show. And it's basically profiling 8 CEOs/investors. And one of those is Warren Buffett. And in there, they basically describe how all of his valuation work is basically done on an A4 sheet of paper. So for years, he didn't have a computer at his desk and stuff like that. And if you're buying big chunks of businesses like he is, I think it makes sense to come back to common sense. And just to say, will this business be bigger? Like, being directionally right is much more important than being specifically wrong. And so, like, people try and pin the point of where this stock should be and what it should be trading at when they don't really understand the company and they don't really understand the industry. And so that's super important. One of the things, it's interesting that you bring that up about the communication strategy that we use at the previous employer that I worked for, we couldn't use the word stock. Like, we couldn't use the stock code. We had to say the company's name if we were talking about it. The only time we could use a shorthand is if it was like an actually long name, and you would actually, then you could shorten it, but you weren't allowed to use stock code. So if someone said, oh, what did you think about the CBA stock price today? The other investors would respond with, what's CBA? Because they weren't allowed to say that. And that's just to reinforce that idea that you should be focused on the business, not the stock.
And it makes it more interesting for an investor to, it's not just a number on the screen, or it's not just a graph of their performance. It's bigger than that.
Mm. Yeah. Like David Gardner says, I want to make my portfolio represent the best version of the future. And so if you just adopt that, like, which companies make, in your mind, make up the best version of the future? If you own that portfolio of companies, you're going to do pretty well, I would say.
Yeah, that's awesome.
A good transition is talking about portfolio risk. And we touched on this a little bit earlier before. Can you talk us through the importance of diversification and building a basket of companies?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. I like how you use companies there, mate.
So, I'm learning. I saw you
hold your tongue just then.
Yeah, sure. So most people, when they build a portfolio, there used to be this rule that you had to get to 30 as quick as you could. So it would be... the old stockbroker rule of thumb was a race to 30. So basically, how quick can you get 30 stocks in your portfolio? That's what they would say. And the reason why is that after about 10 to 15 positions, the correlation, or the way things move in the portfolio, are randomized enough so that the extra benefit of adding more positions doesn't reduce that risk. So that's basically what diversification is. And that's not the basic version. That's kind of the intermediate version. The basic version is, if you are a property investor and you have 5 houses and they're all on the same street, and that street is a flood zone, or that street is subject to bushfires, then you have all of your investments in one kind of street. And if one thing goes wrong, they all get wiped out. So the only difference is, when we talk about stocks as opposed to property, most people get scared in stocks because they're thinking about the ups and downs of the prices as risk. And we're taught as investors and by the media that random up and down that you experience is the risk of the business. That's the risk maybe from one day to the next. But if you look out over 10 years, that's not the risk. And so my philosophy of vesting risk is totally different to what the academic approach is. You know, I am the type of person that if I see a stock price fall by 30 or 40%, I don't click the sell button. I'm more likely to click the buy button. And so I think there's some people that run towards FIRE, some people that run away from it. And that's why everyone kind of has their own risk profile in investing. And I'm sure you're finding this out with financial planning is that, you know, some people are going to be more risk averse. I'm definitely like risk seeking. And, you know, we talked about in this previous episode, starting a business would be one of those examples. Like not everyone starts a business. So basically, if I could sum it up, diversification is about having multiple investments across multiple different types of investing classes. So like shares, bonds, properties, all that sort of stuff, some money in cash, etc. And the way you can do that nowadays, the reason why we don't have to follow that rule of 30 anymore is because we have ETFs. Mm. And ETFs basically give us exposure to more than one investment in a one basket. And so you could have, say, five ETFs. And then if you're so inclined, build the share, individual share positions around the outside. And I would just say, you know, things become a problem when one of your investment positions becomes such a big portion of your portfolio or your wealth that you can't sleep at night. And so when before it gets to that point, that's when you've got to sell some of it.
Yeah, I was literally just about to jump onto that sleep at night factor because, yeah, maybe before you were putting it to a certain number, whether that was 30 or so. And I guess that's more of a principle, less of an actual like get to 30. But it does all, at the end of the day, it comes down to that sleep at night factor. If you're not comfortable holding what you're holding, then there's no point owning it because an investment is meant to be passive at the end of the day. You're meant to be able to put your money in and go do your business or go to your day job or go hang out with friends or family. Mm. And I think you can bring that back to, I guess, conviction and your level of conviction in a certain stock. So can you talk to us a little bit about, I guess, the conviction behind owning stocks and less about the number of stocks you're owning, if that makes sense?
Yeah, sure. So if you were to ask me a question about my business today, I could tell you basically like how many employees there are. I could say, you know, if I was happy to disclose it, I could say like, what are the wages that we pay every month? How many downloads on our podcast do we get? How many members do we have? And all these types of things, right? And so that knowledge of the company that I happen to run makes me much more confident in understanding and making and investing in the business. And so if I didn't have that level of understanding in my own business, there's no way I would have like 90% of my personal wealth tied to the business, right? Mm-hmm. And so if we just think about that from the stock market perspective, if you're buying a business for the long term, like let's say you go and buy Apple shares, which disclosure, something that I own, you would want to know all about the latest iPhones, about the Macs, about the ecosystem, how many users they have, and how they want to disrupt Google and Facebook and all of those other businesses. And you research and research and research and you find out as much as you can about those companies. And what happens is the more you know, if we think about the circle of competence as kind of like a circle of confidence, the closer you are to the center of that circle, the more risk you can afford to take. Mm-hmm. And so what tends to happen is as you research and research and research, you build a picture of what this company is and what it would be like on the inside and its growth trajectory and all that. And the more knowledge you have, the more IP you have on a company, the more risk you can afford to take. And that's basically conviction. And what we've found in some academic studies is that investors who know what they are doing, those are the investors who should take more concentrated bets, meaning they should take fewer, bigger investments. Now, when you're a beginner and you're starting out in the first, say, 3 to 5 years, you don't want to just go all in on a company or all in on an ETF. You should never do that. You should probably stick to those principles or rules of thumb and diversify across ETFs and so on. But over time, pardon me, the more you know about investing, the more you know about individual companies, the more risk you can take.
That was a perfect definition.
Yeah.
Like you summed that up so perfectly. And
thank you.
You said just before that you're more likely to probably buy a company when it's 40% down, where a lot of people would be panic selling at this point.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, that's like sort of the psychology of money.
Ben and I have both experienced this next point for sure. So we all know that we're meant to buy low and sell high, but we always somehow seem to FOMO at a high and then panic sell when it's low. How can investors, especially new investors, combat these tendencies?
Yeah. So I guess keeping a trading journal, like an investing journal, is the easiest way to do it. Because what you'll find is that you're writing for yourself. So you're describing how you're feeling when you make an investment, why you've made an investment, and then you can reflect on it. Most people don't go to the effort of creating a journal for themselves. So what they end up doing is they end up just kind of going by gut feel and not learning from their prior mistakes or successes. And so I think what's really, really important for new investors is to write things down so you can avoid making those mistakes again and again and again. Oftentimes, most of us aren't lucky enough to have a mentor who can give us guidance and can you know, tell us if we're going to make a mistake or at least guide us in the right direction. So you've basically got to be that for yourself. You've got to be your own field guide, and you've got to point out the traps that you saw last time so you don't fall into them again. And keeping a simple training journal is a really easy way to do that. One of the things that you said there was buy low, sell high. If I could nitpick on the words, I would say buy low and buy again. We're told that we should buy low and sell high. And what that actually forces us to think is we've got to find the low point and then we've got to buy it. We've got to sell it at the high point. Mm-hmm. When intuitively, it's actually the companies that stay, that are already high, the highly priced, expensive companies that then go on and outperform. And that's why a lot of professional investors say, water your flowers and not your weeds, which is counterintuitive to that point. So that's a really interesting one too. I would say sometimes FOMO is good. But just make sure it's backed up by a really solid business, and don't be afraid to let it kind of play out over time. Obviously, there are some there's some craziness, and you're going to have to be prepared to ride out the bumps along the way. But I think creating a trading journal and reading about psychology, I think psychology is more important than anything else when it comes to investing.
Yeah, it's a great point. And when we were doing a bit of research into this, we found out like the five sins of investing, or like the psychology behind investing, and one of them is rashness. And we learn about this in one of our units at uni, and also in our own experience. Often people, as you said, told to buy low and sell high, but what people do is they get rash and they're like, oh, I'm up 20%, I'm gonna take my profits. And then what they do is they don't when they're down 20%, they often double down on it. Because their ego is too high to realize that they made a mistake. So what they end up with is like a portfolio of losers. And you're probably you're aware of like that terminology, which is, it's so interesting. It kind of goes on to the next point, because like when it comes down to it, human brains really aren't wired to be naturally great at making investment decisions. Like our biases, our tendencies, our emotions come into play and can influence our decision making and rationality. I'd be really interested, because you've obviously been in the market for multiple years and you've managed wealth, and now you're putting out awesome content. Can you talk us through, I guess, some of the most detrimental and common flaws that you've experienced personally during your time investing, including commonalities you've identified from your time spent interviewing successful investors also?
Yeah, sure. So there's heaps to go on there. Some of the really simple things are just being self-aware. So confirmation bias is one thing that everyone falls trapped for this. And basically what happens with confirmation bias is you seek out information which confirms your views. So like, I'll give you a very good example of this. Let's say that you have a belief about, you know, COVID lockdowns or coronavirus in general. And this is a really polarizing one, and it serves as a good example. And so when you go onto your social media, you go on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, whatever, what you will tend to do, because of your human nature, is you'll tend to follow people that you agree with. So people that say things like, oh yeah, that sounds about right, I'll follow them. And then someone comes out and says, you know, coronavirus is a lie, the government's out to get us, whatever you want to say. And if that disagrees with your perspective, you'll unfollow that person. And so what we're actually doing there is we're grooming our social circle to be narrower and narrower and narrower. And so what happens is, we don't necessarily open ourselves up to the truth because we're seeking out information that confirms our worldview. And so if we apply that same technique to investing, what tends to happen is, on a much smaller micro level, what we're doing is we're seeking out pieces of information that already confirm our view. So for example, you know, I said that Apple's a great company. I use Apple. I'm recording this on an Apple device. Have an iPhone. I love it. It's great, right? So then when I look at Apple's results when they come out, I'm more likely to have a favorable view of what Apple has said and done, just because I'm already in love with it. And so this is something that a lot of new investors do, is they do this without even realizing. They'll say like, oh, well, lithium is going up, and therefore, you know, I sought out this information that says lithium is going to power the new generation, and I'll never forget, you know, never mind that thing called hydrogen, or don't worry about that thing called nickel. Like, those things don't really matter. What we're trying to do is invest in lithium, because that's the number one thing that I heard. And so we tell ourselves this narrative, and we kind of create our own kind of beast. Mm. And the reality is that you often don't know what's right until you know what's wrong. And so, you know, this is why we have a hypothesis when we do scientific testing. We often have to test for the null hypothesis. And so we have to test what we know isn't true, rather than what we know is true. And so it's, I know that always gets people at uni, but basically what we're saying is we know this isn't true. And that's basically what we're trying to do, is like say, okay, this didn't work. It doesn't necessarily say if it comes back and it proves the null hypothesis is wrong, that it's the truth. We're just saying like, we know it didn't work. And so what investors can do is they can effectively, one of the most interesting things that you should do with any investment is basically turn it on its head. And we've already talked about this, and I say this a lot, which is just inversion. So if you want to invest in lithium, tell me the reason why you wouldn't invest in lithium. And by doing so, you invert the question. And, you know, this even happens with professional analysts. You say to them, give me the three reasons why this won't work. And they go into that conversation with you very, very confident that this company is worth investing in. They run through the three things and they go, oh shit, actually, it's not worth investing in, because these three things are pretty big. Mm. And so for new investors, I would say if you get excited about investment, think of the reasons why you wouldn't make that investment before you do. Another really simple thing that you can do, talking about rashness, is you can make a rule to yourself. You can say something like, I won't sell shares if they fall more than 5% in a day. And it's a simple rule, and it avoids you making that decision on the day that the shares are down, and it gives you time to process and go back the next day and think about it and sleep on it. My mom used to have this infuriating rule. Whenever I wanted a new like widget or whatever when I was younger, she would basically say, we'll think about it for 3 days. And I'd be like, what the hell? Like, why 3 days? Like, this is the most ridiculous thing ever. Give it to me now. And then after 3 days, you realize it's not as big of a deal and you don't get it, and you kind of dodged a bullet. So I would say, you know, that 3 day rule probably makes sense for investing too.
I love all of that. And yeah, besides the null hypothesis, that gives me PTSD from statistics. So.
I still don't even know which one was like the null and which one.
I just see the bell curve.
Yeah.
yeah. That's a throwback.
So I guess like now that we know, like you've just told us, we're not naturally great investors. What can we do to, I guess, combat all these? What's the easiest shortcuts, I guess, that you've seen in your time investing, what you've learned about yourself? And like, what are some, let's even just like say two or three simple strategies that, people can combat these personal biases with. And that could even be the way they, like the strategies they take to invest as well.
Like, you can automate a lot of your life. So one of the simple things is a dollar cost averaging, which is where you take money and you effectively, what I would do is transfer a set amount of money every month, like the day after payday. And you can do this with your Up Money bank account or your ING or whatever it is that you use, to automatically transfer that money into your brokerage account every month. And so that process basically takes away your ability to spend that, say it's $500, $200, whatever it is. It takes away that ability to spend that money before you've had your kind of monkey brain kick in overdrive and just go and try and spend that on beer every weekend. You can go and you can put that in your brokerage account, and you know that that money is there. And so this is that old idea of, if you have a jar, you want to put the big things in first and let the little things fall in around that. And that's how you maximize the space in the jar. And so it's the same thing with money, is you want to put the big things in the jar first. You want to prioritize. And one of those things should be investing, because we talked about compound interest at the top of the show. Get that money into that jar as quickly as possible. So in this instance, it would be take that money out of that bank account where you know it can be spent and put it somewhere where you know it's going to be invested. And so automating is really important. The second thing is probably just speaking to people around you. There's a saying that I think there was a gender pronoun in here. I think it was like the man who has no master has a fool for a master. And basically what that saying suggests is that if you don't have someone who mentors you, even from a distance, if it's a book or whatever, you are basically the captain of your own ship, but you won't ever learn from the people who have gone before you and made the same mistakes. So you want to get rid of those mistakes out of your system as quickly as possible. And one of the ways is to see what other people have done. And so like, that's like picking up books. It's like listening to podcasts like these. It's hearing what other people are saying, but actually taking it on board. I didn't do that. I had to learn. Like, I'm one of those kinetic learners where I've got to break something to see that it actually doesn't make sense. So I would say avoid that as much as you can and just see what other people are doing, respectable people are doing. And the final thing is, I don't know, like when you're young, if I could just maybe tailor this to being young, it's not really to avoid the monkey brain, but it's maybe just kind of resetting some expectations, which is just trying to focus more time on, I guess, saving more than doing anything else. So like, for example, what I mean is one of the people that was really influential in my life, who was a successful business person in my personal life, basically said, it's not about how much you earn, it's about how much you keep. And so it's about resetting expectations around that. So, you know, people can go on and become millionaires. And one of the books that we talked about was Psychology of Money by Morgan Housel. He profiles basically someone who worked at, I think it was FedEx or UPS or something like that, and earned like below average, like below minimum wage for his entire life and retired a multimillionaire. And so it's not necessarily about how much you can earn. It's about, I think Morgan says it's like what sits below your humility. And so that would be my thing. So we've got automate your finances, which is really simple to do. It's a behavioral nudge that just basically takes the decision making out of it. I can't remember what my second one was. I think it was, do you guys remember? I can't remember. Number three was probably the most important, which is just resetting your expectations and making sure that you keep as much as you can rather than try and focus too much on making much more. Mm. I think that's a really fundamental point. And that's something that I didn't grasp until later in life. I always thought that, you know, I had to have so much money before I started. I had to do this. I had to do that. Don't worry about that. Just get started.
Second one was mentor.
Yeah.
Mentor.
Yeah. That's a mentor. Yep. Great one. Thanks, man.
And I think another one, which is an absolute killer for everybody, is procrastination and hesitation. Because there would be so many people that firstly haven't downloaded a stock brokerage account, whether that's like Selfwealth or Comsec or something like that. Then there's also like probably a large proportion that have downloaded it, but I've never actually put a dollar into it. It's just like, and maybe it comes back to that anxiety around money and like never being fully like taught it. Or I think procrastination really is like a killer.
Yeah. And that hesitation one ties into your last point about, you know, the money. And I think people say, oh, I don't have enough money to invest. Or it's like, just put even uni students, put $50 away or $100 a week and put that into an account. Or as you said, put it straight into the brokerage.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Mm. And that's, those are all fantastic things. It's like the people that get books, you know, I have a library of books and I've probably read about 20% of them. So, the reality is we all get the books and we all want to make the active decision to read it, but we don't actually follow through. And I think for investing is one of the things that no one should put off in their life because it's actually not that hard. Mm. And the reality is you guys know if you download Selfwealth, Stake, Comsec, insert any broker, fund it with $500, start investing. I'll give you a shortcut. Go and invest in VDHG, which is the ticker code for the Vanguard High Growth Diversified Fund. VDHG, it's like a simple thing. You just get it all in one basket and you can just start with your $500 in that. A lot of people would come on the show and not say something like that, but you know, that's as simple as it is. It could take, you know, less than a day and you're already becoming an investor, which is super empowering.
Yeah, it's great advice. And like, it's a perfect way to learn as well, because once you've got skin in the game, you're then more likely to pull open. Yeah. Do more research around it, but also pull open your investment account. I guess like have a look at like how things work and then what else is interesting. It does compound from there.
Yeah. It's a snowball effect. 100%. I saw that you've been doing some cool work with Selfwealth and doing some tutorials and YouTube videos. How did that come about, your connection with them?
Yeah, so it's just a mutual interest. I think one of the things that happens once you get a little bit bigger is in the industry is people want to reach out to you and help you fulfill your goals, which in fact we have a dual mission at RASC. One of those is to educate basically the next generation of investors. So, and just the generation of people. You don't have to be an investor. You can just be anyone. And they are one of Australia's biggest brokers. So I guess it makes sense that they would want to seek us out to help them educate their audience, but then also for us to partner with them means that we get greater reach. And so, you know, that's just something that we do. And we don't, you know, for your guys' sake, when you, as the podcast grows, right, you don't want to partner with everyone. You want to partner with the people and the organizations that fit well with you philosophically, because you'll get people falling over themselves to want to be sponsors, to want to be advertisers, to want to come on the show, but you want to curate that experience. And so that's just a really important thing. No matter if you do or you don't have your own business, you want to think about how this impacts your brand. Because like one of the things that you want to do is you want to be remarkable. And I don't mean remarkable in the sense of like, you know, on a billboard. I mean remarkable in the sense of people talking after you when you're not in the room. What do they say about you? And I guess this is just a way to say that what happens if people do remark after you, generally have good things come to you. And so that's where that came from.
That's awesome stuff.
Awesome advice. We have to like, I feel like we can't end this interview without picking your brain on, I guess like from your time spent interviewing all these investors and doing your own research, I guess what sector or industry or like even company are you sort of looking at now as something as a awesome like opportunity? What sort of industry are you looking at?
I think one of the things that we may have had in our notes to talk about, which we haven't spoken about, is this idea of the metaverse. And I think we're going to see that a lot more over the next, say, 10 to 20 years, because I don't know what we'll call it, but when it comes. But I think that's something that's going to change. It's literally going to be a new paradigm. And so I think that's something that is totally kind of out there, totally exciting, but don't get caught up in necessarily thinking that it's going to be financially successful very, very soon. I think these ideas typically come in certain waves, and you typically get like this euphoria, then everyone realizes that there's no money to be made, it collapses, and then it comes back again for the second tail. And that's where people actually make money. And so, you know, there are businesses that are trying to knock into this space of virtual reality or augmented reality. We've already mentioned one of the companies that works around that, which is Apple. Apple actually creates this thing called ARKit, which is basically like the underlying coding infrastructure that helps companies and developers build apps where you could say visualize your Tesla in the carport or visualize a piece of IKEA furniture in your house. And so, you know, all of these companies are vying for a spot in that really exciting ecosystem. I'd say that, you know, there are companies that are at the forefront. The companies that I thought were at the forefront a few years ago, which are companies like Activision Blizzard, who create Call of Duty, Take-Two Interactive, which creates NBA 2K, or Grand Theft Auto, like all of these businesses like Riot Games, EA Sports, all of these big game publishers and developers, I thought these businesses would be at the forefront of the metaverse, because I thought that basically, you know, Netflix shows where you can predict your own ending has always been in this realm. We've always thought about them. You know, if you play video games, you would know that you can pick your own ending in video games, right? And so I think they're closer to reaching something like the metaverse as we know it than, say, some of the other technology companies which say that they're doing it but aren't really doing it. So this is all to say that I think that's a really interesting space. I don't know where it goes from here. And for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, like you're just thinking, what the heck is this going on about? The metaverse is basically just being in the internet rather than seeing it. So I went and bought myself some Oculus goggles from Facebook the other week, and you can basically sit inside Angry Birds and shoot the pigs from within the game. And you can use your arms to pull back the bow and arrows or the slingshots and all that sort of stuff. And you can walk around and you can snowboard and you can do all these things, and you can interact with other people online like as if they have an avatar. And so I think that's a huge, huge, huge thing. And I don't know who's going to profit from that, but it's something that I think all investors should watch, because where you see that type of massive game-changing shift in the consciousness is where you'll see opportunities arise in time.
Wow. And I was a big fan of Grand Theft Auto back in my day. Yeah. I saved up that mansion in the city and that Lamborghini. but just on that, like, how have you thought about, and I know this is so long, far into the future, I guess, or not even really, have you thought about how you know, Rask Australia can park themselves on this platform. And, you know, obviously you use podcasts and your website as the platform that you build your business on. But have you thought about the metaverse and the virtual world?
It's actually coming into this discussion. No, I hadn't. Because at the moment, it's basically the ground is so. Just as a digression, what tends to happen in social media and platforms in particular is the early adopters tend to experience exponential growth if they find the right platform. And so the platforms that we have available to us at the moment are like Facebook's metaverse, which is Oculus at the moment. There are others around that, like Samsung is trying to do stuff in that space, and some of the big tech companies, like I'm not sure if you guys are familiar with Google Glass. Google Glass was something that Alphabet/Google created, I think it was like 5 to 10 years ago now. It's like a long time ago. And basically it was glasses that you could put on your head and you could look at a train going past and it would tell you which train it is and if it's on time or not and how much the fare would cost, right? And so in the early days, I thought that was the future, like the ability to have wearable technology that's not you looking down at your phone and crunching numbers with your thumb. And so, you know, what we've found since then is there hasn't really been all of these big businesses have said, oh, yes, we're focusing on this. This is a major focus for us, but no one's actually really done anything about it. Like we could try and get into things like Discord, which is where gamers are, and use those groups to kind of grow our audience. We could use things like, I don't even know, but like any of the social circles that operate around the space and try and use that. But I guess the closest thing that we could probably see as an industry is some sort of virtual reality kind of event or conference in finance where you can meet people in person. But the infrastructure just isn't there, in short. So I haven't explored it.
Yeah, we had just a random chat the other day and we kind of thought like, yeah, how would like a podcast or exactly like us would do that? And we came to the idea of like a little bit where you can meet and it feels so real and you could talk about investing. And
or like
could,
if we're interviewing a guest, like they're there with us. But it's such an interesting space. And it is true though, what you said, like there's a lot of hype around, and I guess that's with any new technology, it runs on an S curve where initially there's a lot of hype and then there's kind of that realization that, yeah, maybe the infrastructure isn't there or like the sediment isn't there. Isn't there like in the, from consumers and from businesses and things like that. So I guess one sort of final point on this, people are obviously getting really excited about this as an investment opportunity, but often with new technology, there's a lot of volatility. Do you think that's something that we could most likely expect and assume? Because I think even within 2001 and during the tech boom, Amazon went down 90%. And now it's, if you had held it all through that, which I doubt anybody did except for obviously the founder of it. Yeah. Now it's one of the biggest companies in the whole world. Can you talk us a little bit about, I guess, the S curve of new technology and things like that?
Yeah, sure. So that's a great point you make. I actually do know one investor who did hold through that. His name is David Gardner, who's the co-founder of The Motley Fool.
Wow.
Yeah.
Actually, I did hear that. Yeah.
Yeah. He made like a truckload of cash, but basically, and for his investors as well that followed him. And I think there's two lessons from that. The first is that one, in order to experience that type of return, you need to invest. So you need to have the investment in the first place. Otherwise you'll never get the return. The second thing is you have to invest for the long term. Otherwise you'll never get the return. And so those are the two things. And you touched on it there, Ben, about risk. You're going to make mistakes. I don't think anyone, well, at least everyone thought they could, but if you went back to 1999 or whatever, before the dot-com bust, you probably wouldn't have been able to say that Amazon's going to be a enormous company and it's going to beat all the other companies that, you know, pets.com and all these other weird companies that we can now look back on and say that was a joke. You would have just been like, oh, yes, there's another one of these guys. Let's see how they go. And so I think we're kind of in that stage in the S curve, which is the S curve is basically where it looks like an S on a chart. You basically have nothing, nothing, nothing. And then all of a sudden it spikes up like an S and then it tailors off once it hits maturity, like it tapers off, sorry. And then it kind of just stops growing. And, what we've seen in recent years is the S curve has got steeper, meaning that adoption from early adopter, from the people that are like the engineers, the gamers, the really weird people that go there first, to maturity of an industry happens faster than ever before. Mm. So we saw that with mobile phones. People moved into mobile phones quicker than they moved into PC computing, for example. And so we're seeing that again now. And the answer is, like, I think the solution to this as an investor and as someone that's interested in the economy of metaverse is basically just making sure you are aware who's in the space and what they're doing. And if you can invest in a part of them, invest in a part of them. Mm-hmm. And so, because if you get just one of them right, it's like this severe asymmetry. You could invest, let's say, $100 in the top 50 companies that are working on this space. So $100 in the top 50, you guys can do the math. But then if one of them becomes 100x, as in goes on to return 100 times your money, you're already making money. Yeah. And so, that's a really kind of law of large numbers of approach to investing in this. But there's a fantastic book on this, which I'll just sneak in the end here, which is called Guerrilla Game, Investing in High Technology. It was written in 1997. It basically has the playbook for this.
Wow. And that all of those points stem to your philosophy, and that's represented and shown in this episode. The way that you talk about your strategy of investing is, time in the market and long-term hold if you have conviction and you've done the research.
So, yeah, that's it. Exactly. Yeah.
That was incredible, I guess.
Actually, I want to pick your brain one more time, really quickly.
Okay.
I know you're where we've had you so long, we're blessed to. What's one book that you would recommend really quickly that you has been really influential in your life?
On investing?
No, anything. One that you think is
anything.
If it's easy, you can pick it on investing.
Okay. So if it's on investing in hyper growth companies, I'd say The Guerrilla Game was really good.
Yep.
But I'd also read that in conjunction with 100 Baggers, which is another great book. I'm just going to give you two more because I thought about them. The first one is for general life. It's called Zen in the Martial Arts. And it sounds as goofy. It is as goofy as it sounds. Zen in the Martial Arts. It's a tiny little book. You can read it in an hour. And it basically teaches you how to be more mindful and just step back from yourself for a little while and just, you know, think positive thoughts and all that sort of stuff. But we talked a little bit about it in our last episode about marketing. And the one thing that I wanted to get across to you guys was this book by a guy called Robert Cialdini, which is, it's called Influence, the Psychology of Persuasion. And it basically talks about how we get manipulated, basically, and how we can use that, those skills to persuade other people. And it's a fantastic book. And it applies to investing as much as it applies to, you know, life in general.
Awesome.
Wow. Cool. That was awesome. We can't thank you enough for taking the time out of your busy schedule. And that has been, the two episodes have been so inspiring for us as people in the same kind of we are on the same path that you have made for yourself. So it was awesome to hear someone that's on the top of that and so inspirational for us at the start of that.
For sure.
And we've learned so much in this, and we definitely know that everyone in our audience would definitely take so many pieces of, there's just gems everywhere.
100%.
So we just want to thank you so much for coming onto the show. We've absolutely loved every single minute of it.
I'm stoked to be here, guys. And hopefully I can come back on in a few years when you guys are famous and you're massive, and I'll probably be begging you to come on. So yeah, thanks for taking the time out.
You know, we definitely have to tee up a little hipster alternative Melbourne coffee soon if we're down there and you can show us a little cafe. So
great
to meet you in person.
I'd happily take you about town and find some good coffee. Don't worry about that.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Owen.
Cheers, guys.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. And if you want to stay up to date with what's new, remember to press follow on your chosen podcast platform.
You can find us on Instagram and LinkedIn at Young Opportunist. Once again, thanks for listening.
Catch you next time.